I want to do a little something different this morning. I want to offer the traditional interpretation of our text from Mark, and then perhaps an alternative interpretation. So what we have in our story thus far is Jesus and his disciples, and indeed a crowd that has been following him, have made it now to Jerusalem. And Jesus knows what lies before him. After all, he's told the disciples the three times at least we have in the scripture story that he will die, but will be raised again on the third day. So Jesus is in the thick of it. He's in Jerusalem, the center of religious life in Judah and Israel. And the scene right before what we have, he's been at odds already with the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders. They have challenged his authority. There has been a back and forth as to whether or not Jesus has the authority that his words have claimed he has. In our text today, Jesus goes on the offensive a little bit, and he tells a parable. He tells a parable about a man who plants a vineyard, puts a fence around it, dug a pit for the wine press, builds a watchtower, then he leases it to tenants and went to another country. The idea, of course, is this man has some capital, he invests it, he calls workers to it, expecting a return on his investment, expecting a profit, expecting those that he hired to do the job for which they were hired. And we think some time has passed between the building and then the sending of the servant, because after all, it takes a while for the crops to really sink in and things to begin to grow for them to be able to turn a profit. So finally, the man sends one of his slaves to go to these people to get some of his return on the investment. Well, we know how the story goes. Messenger after messenger after messenger gets beaten, then beaten, and then finally killed. Those who are the tenants are saying to themselves, if we continue to eliminate the message, it's almost like they're putting fingers in their ears, right? If we push back, eventually this guy will leave us alone and the vineyard will be ours. But that is not how the story ends that Jesus tells. He says, what do you think's going to happen? Right, this rich vineyard owner is not just going to let things lie. He's going to come, perhaps with armed guards, and then he is going to get rid of those, destroy the tenants, and give the vineyards to others who will honor the commitment that I have provided for you an opportunity. However, I want to return on my investment. Now, at the end of the scripture, or at the end of our lesson, on verse 12, it says that the chief priests, the scribes, and the elders, those who Jesus is at odds with in this conversation, realize that the parable was told against them. And they want to arrest Jesus there and then on the spot. But Jesus does have a crowd, those who are following him, and they are afraid. And as you know, the story goes on, and they do it under cover of night, in a kind of duplicitous way. They eventually do arrest Jesus, but for now, they're holding their hand. What do they think Jesus is saying against them in the parable? Well, Jesus borrows a familiar story from the book of Isaiah. In the fifth chapter, Isaiah tells a story, a love song from God to God's people. And basically, it's a sum of just this thing that God has given to the Israelites all that they need to be fruitful. Not fruitful and multiply, okay, that, but more to live life with one another in harmony, to live faithfully with their God in such a way that all the nations of the world will look to this tiny nation and say, ah, teach us the ways that we might live in peace with one another and at peace with our God. But the song in Isaiah, which, by the way, we heard in November. I don't know if you remember that. That was the preaching text then. The issue is not the tenants of the vineyard, it's the grapes. When the owner of the vineyard sends the servant to collect, the grapes are sour. They're worthless. They haven't done a good job, these tenants. They've taken all of this that they have been provided, and it becomes a mess. Sour grapes. That's the issue that God has with Jerusalem in the Israel or in the Isaiah story. Here, though, it's with the tenants. The tenants are holding back on what is rightfully the landowners. So, we take this story, and the traditional explanation is, well, the owner is God, right? God has provided for the nation of Israel, for these chief priests, these scribes, and these elders. He has given them all that they have. And time has come to correct their behavior, to perhaps receive some of the fruits of their labor. And so God sends people. Here we see them as the prophets. We know over and over again in Scripture the people of God reject the prophetic word. And they do some pretty horrible things to the prophets. There's even this one slave that's sent, they beat over the head. And scholars think that's referring to the last of the prophets cut from Old Testament cloth, John the Baptist, whom we know was beheaded. And then finally, the landowner sends the son. Surely they will respect my son. And that is seen as God sending his son, Jesus Christ, the beloved son, whom we've heard twice so far in the Gospel of Mark. Jesus is God's beloved son, once in the baptism, once at the transfiguration. But what do? They kill him. Now they think that it is all theirs. But the story ends on this rather ominous note. What do you think will happen? And what interpreters think what is being said here is that this is a clear indication that Jesus is telling those religious authorities who are in power that that power will be taken away from you. That power will then be given to someone who will steward it in a much better way than you have. It's a condemnation of those in power who have not led, who have not served the people as they have been called to do. And so God is going to undermine the traditional system and replace it with something new, something that honors the words of the prophets, that honors the life and the work of the beloved Son. In short, the work that honors the salvation that God has bestowed not only to them, but to the world. It's an allegory, right? Each part of the story points to something, someone else, in this case, God as the rich landowner, the tenants as those who are in authority, the religious authorities, the servants of the prophets, the Son is Jesus. It's a clear one-to-one. And that is the way that this story has been interpreted over the years. And that's fine. That is a valuable way to receive meaning from the Word and to understand what God is at work at, and what God was at work through the person of Jesus. But there are some problems with that interpretation. So let me retell it in a way that folks have begun to push back a little bit and say, maybe that's not exactly what Jesus is trying to say. And that's a fair thing to do, because Jesus does that himself when he says, you have heard X, Y, Z, basically quoting the Hebrew Scriptures, our Old Testament, but I say to you, and he flips it over. That's the way it was, but there's something new that God is doing in your midst. So it's possible Mark is saying Jesus took this parable that was once understood in one way and is turning it around to say something different. Because again, there are enough differences in what Jesus is saying than a one-to-one correlation with what Isaiah said. All right, so here's how another interpretation might go. A man planted a vineyard, put a fence around it, and dug a pit for the wine press. He built a watchtower. Everything is wonderful so far. There's someone investing in the land. Someone is going to add something to society. And then comes the next line, and this is perhaps the most problematic. Then he leased it to tenants and went to another country. The issue there is, this is an absentee landlord. And we may hear that and think, okay, you know, that's a little dubious at best. But the hearers in the ancient world, if this was street theater, when the man who plants the vineyard is exposed as an absentee landlord, that's when the booing and the hissing and perhaps the rotten fruit would be projected at those who are telling this story. This is the villain. This is the antagonist. Because those who are hearing this story, besides the chief priests, the scribes and the elders, those whom Jesus has called to follow him, those the crowd who has come with him, they've been under the boot of such a system. It's their land that this absentee landlord has gotten through some nefarious gain, and then has invited them to come and work as slaves on what was once theirs. The Old Testament and the New Testament people that we hear about in our scripture understood economy in a drastically different way than we do. Like there's no understanding that if someone has wealth, they can use that wealth to create more wealth, right? To raise the quality of life for all people, right? That's our hope anyway. Whether or not that happens, that's a whole other story. But that's our hope. They had no hope of that. For them, wealth was a piece of the pie. And by definition, if your piece was bigger, that means I have less. That's the way they experienced wealth in the first century. So when they hear this absentee rich landlord, that's when the booing and the hissing begin. That's why this is an alternative understanding of this, because how could that possibly be God? God cannot be the villain and the antagonist in this story. So things go on, and eventually the absentee landlord who hissed sends somebody to come and get some of his produce. They would have understood that as probably an inordinate amount of the produce, a very unfair share that he would collect. And again, this idea that this might be a God figure falls flat. I mean, what does this guy do? He sends a slave. A slave gets beaten and sent back. He sends another slave. He gets beaten and sent back. He sends other slaves. The same thing happens. What does he think is going to happen when he sends his son? But he does. They kill his son. That's not a very wise person to do that. How could this be a God figure? And when all is said and done, you have these tenants who kill the son, and they think, ha-ha, now it's ours. We've got it. Assuming by first century law that if the son is coming, that must mean the father is dead, and if we kill the son, then there's no one to claim this inheritance. It will be ours. But they misread the entire situation, and this landowner finally comes, and he devastates, he destroys the tenants, and he gives the vineyard to others. Again, a problematic phrase. He destroys the tenants. Again, what kind of God is this that would do that? So, an alternative understanding of this text might hinge on the psalm that Jesus quotes in verse 10. The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. This was the Lord's doing. It is amazing in their eyes. What is it that Jesus is rejecting, what he is claiming they are rejecting is the mission that Jesus came to love, to have compassion, to offer mercy, to extend forgiveness. I think the alternative reading is saying what is being shown here is a system of violence. One violent act begets another violent act. There is an act of violence and things escalate to where there is total destruction of the tenants. What God offers through the person of Jesus is unconditional love and self-giving sacrifice. That is what Jesus faces as Jesus walks to the cross and to his death, but of course, ultimately, his resurrection. The alternate reading suggests that you may think you have won the battle, but no one wins the war. Violence only begets more violence. The only way out of that cycle is to undermine the powers that be that would seek to wreak violence with the power of love and sacrifice. That is why Jesus came, and that is why Jesus did what Jesus did. For love and to offer sacrifice, to undermine the violence of this world. His message of love and understanding, of welcoming, that's what's being rejected by those who are in power. This understanding of unconditional love and self-sacrifice, that becomes the cornerstone of the whole Jesus movement after his resurrection. God calls to God's self through the person of Jesus those who would extend love, those who would welcome the stranger and the marginalized and the oppressed. Jesus does not come to participate in a system of violence. By giving into it through the death and then the resurrection, Jesus uses the power of love to undermine what those who would seek to kill him have in mind for him. Quite an alternative reading, is it not? But I think it's powerful. And it takes into mind, again, what the first century hearers of this text from Mark would have experienced when they heard this story. To understand, to put ourselves in their place and understand what they were experiencing as their lands were taken. as they hear the story of the Old Testament that talks about, well, Egypt being supplanted by Assyria, Assyria being supplanted by Babylon, Babylon being supplanted by Persia. One after another, this system of violence has raised someone to the top, only to be struck down when the next more violent power comes along. Jesus is saying that is at an end. God offers to the world, through me, the Messiah, a way to undermine that.